Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Super architect Frank Gehry brought the word curvilinear to The Simpsons and a revolution to global architectural design. He didn't want modernism with its cold, hard lines. He didn't want postmodernism with its decorative nods to history. He wanted something new on global skylines from Bilbao to Los Angeles to Hong Kong to New York, and he has made it, soaring, challenging buildings that deconstruct old forms and play with thrilling new ones. This hour on Point, architect, artist Frank Gehry on creative design and the meaning of what humans build. You can join the conversation. When did a Frank Gehry design first grab you, and why? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Frank Gehry joins us today from Los Angeles, where his architectural firm is based. Vanity Fair calls him the most important architect of our age. His built designs include the Gehry Residence in Santa Monica, his own house when nobody else was yet sure about his way, the soaring Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles, where everybody was sure, the famous Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, the project that made him world famous, a household name. His newest works include the New World Concert Hall in Miami and the towering organic skyscraper 8 Spruce Street in New York City. He has projects underway in Hong Kong and Abu Dhabi. Frank Gehry, welcome to the show. It's wonderful to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you.
I think.
Well, we hope so. We hope so.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
I wanted to ask, just at the get-go, we look at these exuberant designs, and as a layman looking what you design, what gets built, I just find myself wondering if you create these designs strictly for the joy of the design, of the creation, or to influence the people who live in and around them?
More to inspire them and to make them feel good. There's a history, a trajectory of curved forms used by sculptors through the ages. And the Greeks expressed movement in stone with inert materials. The Indian Shiva dancing figures in bronze mm-hmm. have a sense of movement, and living in a world that's all filled with movement, it seemed to be an appropriate place to look for a humanizing element for architecture. And the folds are very primitive, and you're in your mother's arms and held inside folded garments. They seem to be an important part of our lives, and I've learned to express that.
Absolutely. Yet, I mean, if you go, you know, you mentioned the Greeks, you go to Athens and look out across the city there, and no matter where you are in the city, there's the Parthenon on the Acropolis with its sharply geometric lines, very straight. In a way, you can look at that and see a kind of germ for a lot of Western thought. Yes. Are you trying to free us from that, break us out of that, add to that?
Well, I was looking at the sculptures. I was looking mm-hmm. at the yep. marbles that mm-hmm. are in the British Museum, which I just went to visit. I pay a visit every year if I can. They're very inspirational. You see, you feel the movement of the horses and the warriors in the stone, and I was inspired by that to bring it to a building.
The Elgin marbles there, and definitely movement there. The famous story, you've heard it or told it a million times, I suppose, is that part of your inspiration may go back to carp that your grandmother kept around the corner from your house in the bathtub to make gefilte fish on Thursdays or Fridays.
That came. I threw that in after I got involved with the fish. Came about because when everybody started postmodern and going back in history, I pronounced in one of my lectures, if you're going to go back, why not go back 300 million years before man to fish? And then I started drawing in my sketchbook the fish forms, which, you know, I'd study the Japanese woodcuts and beautiful drawings of carp and things like that. And they do express movement. They are very architectural. And so I tried exploring that and did a few rooms, sculptural rooms that came from the fish shape, and found them to resonate. People liked them. People felt comfortable in them. They were, and so out of that came the ability to make those shapes architecturally. I explored how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hard if you know the little kits you buy in the museums for dinosaurs. Those pieces are all different shapes, but they hook onto a spine and then they form the three-dimensional shape. It's very similar to that. That's how I started it.
Translating that to buildings that will stand and people will walk in has required a lot of technology, though. What about that? What about the computer base that you've built behind the work, your own work, and the work of your firm, I guess, Gary Partners?
Yeah, and now we're spreading it to all our colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't build it. I couldn't define it with the standard tools of two-dimensional tools. And I got involved with the aircraft industry's software, CATIA, which is made by the French, Dassault. And
aircraft, because they're round and still strong.
Yes,
or the curve,
and they do
strong.
Airplanes and boats and cars and things like that. And we found that complicated to use, but over time developed an overlay for it to simplify it for our use in buildings. And when I started to use it, Bilbao was in my office, and no two pieces of steel were the same size in that building.
Because of what? The swooping and
because
curving
of the shapes.
Wouldn't allow it.
We were using that you couldn't. It's not like
one floor repeated 100 times to the sky.
Right.
It's all different.
We sent a team over and taught the subcontractors how to read the documents and how to read these shapes. And six bidders for the steel structure came in 1% spread, which means the documents are very tight when you get that, and it makes you feel very secure.
Okay.
And they were 18% under budget. That's when I knew something. I had an amazing tool that would serve me well going forward.
In that aircraft
It's proven to be extraordinary. The Beekman Tower exterior skin. I get into the economics of it because it's so important to realizing these buildings. And
sure.
If I ask 50 people in a room to respond, are my buildings expensive? 49 of them would put up their hands.
Must be.
Mm-hmm. And it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how to break out of that perception but the Beekman Tower, the exterior curtain wall was bid at $200 a square foot, the same price as flat buildings in New York at the time. And we finished the building with no change orders. So all the other buildings had 15% change orders. So in the end, their curtain wall cost $230 a square foot, and ours stayed at $200. And ours looks like it's expensive. So
what does that mean to you? Does it mean we might be looking at a future where this kind of swooping, soaring, curving architecture becomes the norm? I mean, I know it's grown a lot, because of your influence, but could it become commonplace?
Well, it just means it's freer, that you can make architecture, real architecture, I hope. Competitive with the norm, with the, you know, 98% of the buildings built in the world are, I wouldn't call architecture. So that's who we're competing with. If we can put a product, a building on in place for the same price or less than the norm, and it has some juice in it, some excitement, some inspiration, some feeling, and people like it, then why not? It doesn't preclude minimalism or other people doing very simple buildings or not liking sensuous buildings.
Do you think we'll see whole cities of sensuous buildings?
I don't know.
Science fiction often shows that. You know, it looks organic, gnarly, curvy, tendrily cities. Is that the Geary path that we've put
our feet on? No, it's not what I'm not looking for that. I think if you look at the Beekman Tower, the Spruce Street, you mm-hmm. called it, mm-hmm. I worked very hard to make it a New York building and to be very respectful of the Woolworth building standing next to it, mm-hmm. which is
the verticality, beautiful. The upward thrust.
So, mm-hmm. It's carefully placed in its time and place. So I'm not trying to build. The kids are out there doing that stuff now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today with super architect Frank Geary about his soaring, crumpled, asymmetrical, stunning style from Bilbao to Los Angeles and the meaning of what humans build. One of the most honored architects out there, the architect of our age, Vanity Fair says, and they're not the only ones. He joins us today from Los Angeles. Frank Geary, all over the place in design, and not just in design. Here's a little bit from a 2005 episode of The Simpsons. The town of Springfield has hired Frank Geary, no less, to build them a concert hall to show the residents of a rival town that they weren't hicks and morons. Here, with Marge Smith, Frank Geary, playing himself, unveils the new hall.
Behold, the new Springfield Concert Hall. And none of this would have happened if not for a letter I received from one little girl.
I wrote that letter.
You wrote I was the bestest architect in the world?
Well, aren't you?
All in favor of building a $30 million screw you to Shelbyville?
Aye, and the next thing you know, Frank is outside, the cartoon figure thereof, outside that concert hall, and there are, they're skating, they're skateboarding on his building.
Get off my masterpiece, you punks. I'll call your mothers.
Yo, Frank Geary, like curvy linear forms much?
Curvy linear. You're a good sport, Frank, to do that, but it stuck with you a little bit because they show you there just crumpling up the letter from Marge at one point, tossing it on the ground and finding your design there. I think some people have thought, well, maybe it's something like that. How does it work, Frank?
It's not like that, I'll tell you.
And yet I've seen the sketches for your designs, and they're very, very free. Not what, maybe at least lay people think of, you know, tight designs and blueprints and this sort of meticulous depiction. It's kind of...
Well, those sketches aren't made for the public. Those are my personal mm-hmm. little notes, and I mm-hmm. think that's the way I think. So they are free expressions. But sometimes they look close to the finished building. I don't know how that happens. There's a magic trick somewhere in there.
How does it work when you're at your level? Do you take those sketches and hand them to a squadron of young architects who make it real? Are you, you know, with your shirt sleeves rolled up right in there with them?
I wish it would be that easy. No, we spend a lot of time analyzing the program, the site, the budget, the time constraints, and really get to know the problem and be able to actualize it in three-dimensional with just blocks so I understand the scale of it. And then once we understand all of that, which takes, you know, in any project, it could take 6 to 8 weeks of intense study of it with mm-hmm. the client, with the mm-hmm. Bureaucracy that has to approve it and donors, et cetera, in the case of more public building. Once we're there, once we understand it, then I feel kind of free to start sketching and fantasizing where this might go. But it's dealt with very tight to the bone. So if our building's 90% or more come in on budget or close to the budget, and to do that is not easy in a volatile world. So we're constantly testing the surface area, the floor areas, the volumes, the And we use the computer to do that. And those curves have to be rationalized. If you make a big curved wall out of stone, flat stone is one. It would be one point, and cylindrical stone would be two times the cost of flat, and spherical stone would be 10 times the cost of flat. So by using the computer, you can distill out the more expensive parts and keep it to a minimum, and develop a cost model that's real for any of those buildings. So it's not – the sketches, I think, express the feeling more than the actual construction. It's my own shorthand.
Shorthand.
The kids in the office or the other people in the office look at them, but I don't think they sit down and try to build that.
There's a lot of talk about your influence globally. And in the news this week, we've seen, of course, Jeanne Gang of Chicago with her Aqua Tower in Chicago in the news, winner of the MacArthur, what they call Genius Grant. So that's gotten a lot of exposure. And I'm looking here on my tabletop at her tower there, very tall, clearly a skyscraper, and these kind of wavy surround cloud sort of forms, she said, are there in part to sort of baffle the wind and make those terraces livable. And next to it, your Beekman Tower, your 8 Spruce Street in New York. You know, they both have this, at first glance, you could say these are in the same family, but I wonder if you see it that way. There's this kind of organic curves and forms and sort of drapery folds on yours. Hers are more curves, but do you see Jeanne Gang's architecture as in the Frank Gehry family, universe, realm?
God, I don't know. I don't think of it that way, but I like her work. I think she's a very interesting architect.
And why would you not? Because to my lay eye, here they are. You know, they're both sort of breaking planes.
Well, my spaces on my breaking planes create bay windows inside the building. So they create a space inside the building. And it's like a bay window in any building. It's you walk to the bay window and you're kind of outside, you get the feeling. And so when you do that on the 70th floor, it's staggeringly beautiful. The feeling is good. On hers, they're outdoor balconies.
So they're just on the exterior of a box.
The window walls are more flat.
There's more elemental to the structure.
But when you look from the ground up, there could be a sense of similarity. I don't think they are in reality.
The great Frank Gehry is with us today and joining us from Los Angeles. Frank, we've got lots of listeners calling in for you. Peter in Franklin, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Peter. You're on the air with Frank Gehry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm interested. The first building I ever saw outside the U.S. wasn't Balboa, but was in Prague. And it was right on the river. And I'm interested about the way in which that fits into the amazing city itself of Prague. And if you could just comment on that. I found it probably a smaller kind of representation of what he did. How early was it done? And any thoughts about it to just tell us? We were amazed. We're big fans of Frank Gehry.
Great. Peter, thank you. Frank, what do you say?
Well, that building came about when Václav Havel was released from prison. He and his family lived in the building next to it. And the building was bombed by an American on a mistake run on the Dresden run.
In World War
II.
So
broken structure, and when he came out, he wanted to fix that. It's a small building, and I looked at the context, the 19th century context. The windows, the floors of the 19th century buildings are taller, and we had to put 7 floors adjacent to a 4-floor building, and so I used the windows. I moved them up and down. So in one of them sits right tight to the floor and one of them sits tight to the ceiling. And to create a texture of that could blur the relationship to those other floors. The 19th century facades along the river all terminate with some kind of curvilinear tower with a turret on it or a roof or something. And so parallel to the river, the first move was to do that. And I think that's the piece that ended up being called Fred. And then the city wanted to move the road that came from the city toward the river, toward the bridge, to point toward the bridge. So they gave us the piece of land, the triangle of land that created. And that's when I put the glass tower facing the plaza and would signal the turn of the road toward the river. When I built that in the model, the guy, the first building toward the city, had a balcony that he looked at the castle from, and I realized my building was going to block that. So I pinched it in and created a waist, which looked feminine, which looked like a dress. And that's when the citizens started calling it Ginger and Fred. I got a lot of flack for that because it was innocently done, but the citizens thought that I was bringing Hollywood kitsch to Prague, and they're very proud of their visual intellects and their interest in abstraction. And
justly.
Havel himself took me to task and said, you know, we're very proud of our art and architecture from the past, and it's not representational. Why are you doing this? And I had to explain to him that I wasn't.
It wasn't Fred and Ginger.
It wasn't really very abstract. Mm-hmm. And when I showed all of the models up to it, they understood, and it was embraced from then on. It's called Fred and Ginger.
Whether you like it or not, are they?
Yeah.
How do you think about this whole idea of when you begin to look at a site for a building, of fitting in versus maybe a deliberate tension with the existing environment where a Frank Gehry work is going to go?
Well, it depends on the project. I think historically, public buildings like courthouses and libraries and concert halls and opera houses have a sort of, I think, almost requirement to be iconically have a presence, and that's the history of architecture. It's always done that. Whereas housing and infill buildings and it depends on where they are, but like in Prague, it absolutely required that. For me, anyway, that there be a sense of fitting in, but without pandering. I think when you copy the environment, you're speaking down to it. You're insulting it. I've always felt that. Mm-hmm. I think I was raised as a kid not to talk down to people, and the same applies to architecture. But in Bilbao, I did. They asked for the Sydney Opera House. That was my first meeting. Mm-hmm. They said,
we want
something spectacular. Mm-hmm. The site was spectacular that they finally settled on. And it had wide open spaces on three sides. So I anchored it to the 19th century city and then exploded on the riverfront. But if you go to Bilbao 50 years from now and you don't know Frank Gehry or anybody, and you look at that building, you say, what is that, maybe? And they tell you it's the art museum, and then you got to say, well, these people really loved art.
Yeah, there's clearly love there. We've got a listener online, Ashwin asks, has origami influenced you?
I don't know that I can consciously say it influenced me. I've looked at origami, and when I was starting out in architecture, there was a heavy influence of the Japanese temples and mm-hmm. Japanese art and architecture because my teachers were returning GIs. They'd experienced that wonderful culture, architectural culture. And it was easy to assimilate or to be inspired by it in Southern California with the wood frame buildings mm-hmm. that we were building. And so it was an easy... So I studied Japanese culture. I even played in a gagaku orchestra when I was a kid. I got into the music, the mm-hmm. art, and literature and the whole thing. But
not origami specifically.
I don't know. I mean, it was there.
Yeah, it was there. Aaron in Burlington, Vermont is calling. Aaron, you're on the air with Frank Gehry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Mr. Gehry, I'm a big admirer of your work, and I visited the Guggenheim Bilbao several years ago. And while I was struck by the beauty of the exterior of it, the interior is what really fascinated me and the way you kind of reworked that into an art space. And I wonder if you could speak to kind of the utility of displaying visual art and how you went about that process.
Well, there's a there's a whole culture of museum directors and people who build museums that sends you to being very neutral, and neutral buildings, and not competing with the art. And so Bilbao was criticized for competing with the art. I grew up with all the artists of my time, Rauschenberg and Oldenburg mm-hmm. and Stella and whoever. And they always talked about the nauseating neutrality of most museums. They wanted somebody to stand up and be seen that they could react against or with. Or mm-hmm. And there's a certain pride in being part of a building that has juice in it, if I can use that word. And so I think it's museum curators and directors, I think... I remember when I finished Bilbao, there was a fatwa, so to speak, put out by museum directors that not to let me do it again.
Does your outside design necessarily then compete with the art inside? Those same swooping lines are around what's hanging in the museum to our caller's question about the interior space that results?
No, the interior space, the changing galleries, which mm-hmm. have... for the most part, are dealing with living artists, have some curves in them that haven't been worrisome to anybody. Saul Lewitt did the first show, and he did a painting inside that and very beautifully. We made some classical galleries for the artists who were not alive, so they couldn't defend themselves, so to speak. So,
right.
And I think it's worked very well. The best museum curators are always telling me how great it is to install shows there. And when I see the ubiquitous, minimal galleries that people build, including Museum of Modern Art in New York, you got to wonder. They say it's neutral, but it isn't. There's right. no such thing as neutral.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the great architect Frank Gehry, winner of the Pritzker Prize and admiration around the world for his daring, soaring, crumpled, sometimes asymmetrical, almost always stunning designs from Bilbao to Los Angeles, New York City, all over, you name it. I should say there's a terrific photo gallery of his work at our website, onpointradio.org. He joins us today from Los Angeles. And let's go right to Vail, Colorado. And Rick. Rick, thanks for calling. You're on there with Frank Gehry.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I was just calling. I'm an architectural photographer, and we have a studio here in Vail and in New York as well. And I'm a huge fan, and Frank is the reason, really, I got into architectural photography. I'm pretty young, and he was the first person to really kind of expose me to the art form of architecture, and I really just want to thank him for everything he does. I wish more projects were we're kind of based in that art form approach to architecture that I get to shoot, but every once in a while we approach a project that I get really excited about. And
Rick, what is it about Gary's work that pulled you into your whole career here? What is it?
I don't know. It's hard to explain. Just something about the curves of it, the way it takes light and reflects light, and like I said, it's sculpture. So I'm just a huge fan, and I'm super excited to be able to call and tell him that.
Mr. Gary?
Thank you.
So the salute back to you. Yes, Frank, sorry. Good. It's great to have you, Rick. Great to have you call. Frank, here's a listener online. Brian asks, how do you think future critics should interpret deconstructivism, the tag that gets put on a lot of your work? What are you trying to say, Brian asks?
Well, I'm not a deconstructivite.
Okay.
I think that's been a misnomer. Mm-hmm. You know, you get included in things quite often without anybody realizing what they're... You know, it's onomatopoetic.
Yes.
That if you use the word deconstructive and you look at my work, it seems to fit. I think it's just that. I did meet Derrida, and I mm-hmm. did talk to him, who is the mm-hmm. father of deconstructivism. And he assured me that I was not one.
So leave the tag out. We all look back on architecture. It's inevitable that people will look back on what you've built.
It doesn't matter, yeah.
What do you hope that they interpret when we're all long gone, you were trying to say?
Well, it's a personal thing. It's not, obviously, it's not, everybody doesn't like it, and that's healthy. But I've always learned to be myself, and the number of buildings I do in a lifetime isn't going to screw up the world. I think there are a lot of other people out there doing a better job at that than I am. The buildings work for the most part. The concert hall has been lauded as
terrific,
best sound. By the Berlin Philharmonic, by Simon Rattle, by a lot of great musicians, and it's the one building I use because I go to concerts all the time.
But do you think they'll see this late 20th century, early 21st century architect trying to escape history, speak to history, point a new way?
Well, I don't think I'm escaping history. You know, you don't do that. I'm a student of history. I mm-hmm. spend a lot of time studying architectural history and art history and classical music history and whatever. But I think there's no reason to escape it. There's a reason to take it somewhere.
A lot of postmodernists.
To be inspired by it.
Yeah, a lot of postmodernists spoke to history much more directly. You know, they sort of brought it back after modernism and all those...
Well,
sharp
you can
line.
See why, because the post-war modernism was a bastardization of some great architects like Mies van der Rohe. And when it got translated into the commercial realm, it lost its gravitas, so to speak. And it became cold and inhuman. And most of our cities around the world are built on that model. So we're looking for humanity, and if... You either invent a way to do it, which I've been trying to do, or you use the past. The great thing that postmodernism did was created a pluralistic landscape for architecture. It opened the doors for many thoughts, and it sort of democratized the field, I think. And I think that's valuable. That means there's a lot of voices out there, a lot of people doing things. I don't always like it, but I do like a lot of my colleagues, like Zaha Hadid and Rem Koolhaas, mm-hmm. and I support them wholeheartedly.
I've always wondered what it was in your life or in the atmosphere that led you kind of taking off. I mean, you did a lot of work earlier in your career for commercial development, James Rouse, a lot of those big developments, and tremendous work. It was widely applauded, but, you know, then you just, I mean, you broke out. Bilbao was when the world heard it. But what was going on? You weren't a kid anymore when you did that. What was going on in your life that sort of set you free to go so prominently up that way?
Well, I realized that even the great Jim Rouse had a pro forma, and it wasn't easy to break out of it. I didn't have enough juice or power in my world to do that.
And out of the sort of presumed requirements of his
right.
commercial spaces.
And, you know, since then, a lot of people have, but it was a point in time. I had a very well-known meeting with the Rouse Company and with Matt DeVito, who was the president at the time. And we were sitting in my house, and he looked at my house, the one on 22nd Street in Santa Monica, and he said,
famous,
do you like this? And I said, yes, I do. And then he pointed to the shopping center, and he said, well, you can't possibly like that. And I said, well, it's not as good as this, but I'm still did it, and I'm, you know, I did what I could. He said, well, why do you do that? You shouldn't do that. You should just do what you love. And he was right, and so we agreed not to work together at that dinner.
If this is what you love, and this was sort of busting out of lines and planes and putting all kinds of stuff.
Now that shopping center's been torn down. It's been rebuilt.
And yeah.
I don't know. But he set me free, and it was a momentous occasion. I had to go in the office and let 40 people go, I think, that Monday.
Wow.
And start from scratch. But probably the best thing I could ever do. I think I grew up in a Jewish family, and my grandfather used to read Talmud to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the Talmud starts with the question, why? So it's you know, those old guys sitting around that talk, and the old Jewish guys, and they argue with each other on fine points, like how many angels on the head of a pin kind of stuff.
Yep.
But it's always why, and I was raised to ask why. So I'm curious always about where things go, and I never plan to go somewhere. I allow I trust my intuition somehow, and it's led me to these funny places.
A lot of them, and a lot of us looking at them, sometimes with jaws dropped. Jim in Newton, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Frank Gehry. Thanks for calling, Jim.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My son went to Bard College up north of New York City, and there's a very beautiful performance art center that Mr. Gehry was the architect for. We always love seeing it, but there's a practical issue with this building, which has these long sloping edges on the very irregularly shaped roof.
Mm-hmm.
And in the wintertime, when snow and ice forms on it, these amazing shards of ice can come flying down off the roof. So, in fact, they have to set up barriers all around the building so that people aren't injured by this.
Yikes.
And I've always wondered, you know, if Mr. Gehry had any thoughts about that. It's really an issue with the building, and I'd love to hear his comments about this.
Yeah, Jim, we'll do it. Beautiful building at Bard, indeed. Frank, we've got a lot of comments online. People along this line saying, hey, great, but what about, you know, leaking water, falling ice? What about the practical issues that come with Frank Gehry's designs? What about it?
Okay, which one do you want? Falling ice first?
Okay, sure.
So there are stainless steel rods that are welded into the edge is the solution to that, and it holds back the ice. And then the leading edge of the roof has a heat strip, which melts it before it forms that. Now, I don't remember in Bard. It could have been value engineered out. They're expensive, but that's the only way you can do that. And it's done throughout the East Coast and wherever there's that kind of buildup.
But it's still got the fence around it because people are afraid of the ice.
Yeah,
I guess.
I mean, I should I thank you for bringing it to my attention. I'll talk to Mr. Botstein and see what I can do about it. It shouldn't happen that way, and I do think we designed it properly, and maybe it was left out. The case of leaks, we have a terrific track record of non-leakable buildings. These things go to lawsuits, so I'm not at liberty to say what happened, but it's quite often, and it's proving to be in many of the buildings, that the supervision by the general contractor connecting the dots when the different trades, usually it's the curtain wall to the glass, that they leave out the waterproofing. And in many of our buildings, we find when there are leaks, and not many, and it's just in one case up around your area.
In our backyard, the Stata Center at MIT, there's been big suits about that, big money, big complaints about the leaking there.
Yeah, the complaints haven't been coming from the user group who assure me they don't care, they love the building. But as they've opened it up, they found that missing connectivity of the waterproofing
along the curtain wall there. Is it possible to have to go down the Frank Gehry path and not push the contractors and the building of it to the edge where those lapses?
Well, we're very precise mm-hmm. in our drawings of mm-hmm. what they have to do, and Bilbao does not leak, mm-hmm. and Disney Hall does not leak, and Beekman Tower does not leak, and this one building, these things happen, and it's being corrected, and I don't believe we did it.
I got a lot of questions
what
here.
What we do mm-hmm. is there's a high-powered water test at the end of each construction before they close up the building finally. Mm-hmm. And that usually points to these deficiencies where the waterproofing didn't connect. And the high-power water test was not done at MIT.
There are a lot of questions here on the future of building and green building. And here's one online from Merrick. And Merrick says, Frank Gehry, Buckminster Fuller, Christo have convinced old-school city leaders and egos to think and build outside the box. Question put here is, who will lead us away from car-dependent sprawl? Why can't we build highly sustainable, low-cost, car-free, green pyramid-like cascading cities? Merrick's complimenting you, saying, look, you've helped people break out of their way of thinking in design terms. What about breaking out in green terms? And here's another on those lines. David says the future of buildings must be zero net energy. Sure, they can be elegant and exciting, but if they aren't designed to address the climate crisis, they're an extravagant waste. What about those observations, that question?
Well, I think most architects my age that have been responsible in their efforts have dealt with all of those issues from the beginning. I remember I have a talk I gave in the 60s about that. My house that I live in has a skylight at the top, and when the weather turns hot in L.A., which is 2 weeks a year maybe, I go in there, I push the button, it opens the skylight, in 15 minutes the room is cooled. It's like the teepee. So those things are great things. They've become a cult of sustainability, approval of, you get points, a lot of people are questioning it now. They've studied those buildings that have gotten all those points and gotten all those approvals.
Points for environmental friendliness.
Yeah, most of them have proven not to deliver. The tower in New York was built with a 50% less carbon cement. So the whole building in concrete should get points for that, if you would, but nobody applies for it. But it saved a lot of carbon footprint. The building was built in less time. None of the batches of concrete were wasted.
Mm-hmm.
And so human effort is part of this, I think.
But is it time for a cult of sustainability now? Is that time come?
Well, I think we're in a dangerous period with our planet. Absolutely. We have to address it, but we should address it. The biggest push has to come politically. I went to a conference of on sustainability in Aspen once, and everybody came in their private jet. And I said, you know, you guys used up the carbon footprint of the world in one meeting to talk about sustainability. I proposed something in Germany about 15 years ago, and it kind of worked for an energy company, that you have bicycles outside the building and tie it into the grid. So the energy of people doing their exercise is captured. And I think if every gym in the world signed up to that, we'd save energy. But there's a lot of ways to do it. I just think it's become a funny cult, and it's problematic what it's delivered. I think it's a real issue, and we have to deal with it.
Many ways of going at green. Frank Gehry, not ready to go cult-wise there. Of course, I guess a lot of these things are in the eye of the beholder. The beauty of your buildings clearly in the eye of the beholder, and beloved by many. Frank Gehry, it's been terrific speaking with you today. We're really grateful for your time, for your work, and for you spending the hour with us. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Frank Gehry, great architect. A gallery of his work is at our website, onpointradio.org. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.